you want to see all that stuff? Think about your own mind, and you have to read many minds like that all the time. Is that interesting? Chances are it's actually very, very uninteresting here. So unless you have a very good reason for reading minds, maybe you are a meditation teacher, and maybe you think you can help others by reading minds. Maybe then it's good. But even then, probably not all that interesting here, because you already know what the defilements people have already. You know what they are. Again, we all have the same problems usually. So can it happen after the first, second, third, and fourth jhana? Yes, it can happen after the fourth jhana, especially. You can learn these things if you apply yourself in the right way. But by the time you get to the fourth jhana, you probably lost all interest in reading any minds whatsoever. Because you ask yourself, why should I bother? What's the point of all that? Okay, very good. Dear Arjan, by being a passive observer, can one become an arahat? Remember that all of the things we do here are part of the path, right? So, and the path includes the idea of being a passive observer. The passive observer just means to be mindful. That's all it means. You're learning to be mindful. You're learning to withdraw from the world. You're learning to create a space between yourself and the things that you are seeing. So that you are seeing things. And you can see, sometimes you can see your thinking mind, right? You have like space between yourself and your thoughts. And you can see the thinking going on. And as you keep observing that, the thoughts start to die down and they become very peaceful. So it's part of the path to be the passive observer in this way. It's part of the thing that leads you in the right direction. But then you want to take it further, right? You want to go beyond being just a passive observer. You want to give rise to all the joy and the happinesses on the path that I've been talking about before. Because it is the joy and the happiness of the path that will eventually take you into a real state of samadhi, a real state of profound peace and stillness, where all the defilements are gone. And after the defilements are gone, then you can be the passive observer again, right? But now you're a different type of passive observer. Now you are extremely passive observer. You can just watch things arising and passing away, absolutely everything, with crystal clarity. And that kind of passive observer you have after a deep state of samadhi, it is much more powerful and gives rise to much more insight than the passive observer you had before. You can see things popping out of existence, popping into existence, disappearing again with extreme clarity. And this is what we really want to do. Also, what you can also do when you come out of a jhana is to reflect back. And this is perhaps the more common way for achieving insight as well. Reflect back on what happened. Reflect back on the things that disappeared when you went into a state of samadhi. And understanding impermanence, non-self and suffering on the basis of seeing that specifically. So passive observer is always good. But there's many, like with everything else, there's many degrees of being a passive observer, right? It kind of starts off and then it kind of moves along and becomes more and more powerful until it has lots and lots of power. And that's when it becomes very useful for developing wisdom and understanding. Passive observer is not one thing. It is a kind of all of these things coming, this whole kanda, this whole aggregate of different states. Okay, just wanted to share. So first one, rituals can be aids to mindfulness. Bowing helps prepare me for meditation, makes me stop before I sit. Thanks for the wonderful retreat. We had a question yesterday about bowing, and here somebody said that it can be an aid to mindfulness. It can put you in the right mood, perhaps, in the right mind state when you bow down. It kind of takes away perhaps a bit of the sense of self, and you feel a bit more okay. You can relax a bit more, perhaps. So that's good. Thank you for that. Okay. Dear Arjan, I find the background stories to the Dhammapada to be highly entertaining, if not fantastical. Would I be correct in thinking that these stories evolved quite a bit later than the Dhammapada itself? Perhaps in the same way folk tales would have in other times and places. P.S. Thanks so much for giving this retreat. It's been an awesome Dhamma experience. Okay, very good. So yes, that is quite correct. That is exactly what is going on there. And this is true in the Dhammapada. It's true in many of the other books of Buddhism as well, that you have these kind of verses or short little sayings of the Buddha, and then these stories seem to have evolved afterwards. The same is true for the Jatakas of the past lives of the Buddha. You have some small verses, which are the most ancient ones, and then the stories very often evolved afterwards. So that came much, much later. And generally, you have a point that the more fantastical things are, the more amazing it is, the more psychic powers you find, the more kind of stuff which seems really hard to perhaps accept at face value. The more that you have, the longer usually you are after the time of the Buddha. It's almost as if people have this need to remember the Buddha in a certain way, so they build up these stories afterwards. So that is quite true. Okay. Okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn, being the last Q&A session, it is time to express our gratitude for the excellent teachings that you offer to us during this retreat. This is undoubtedly one of the best, if not the best, Dhamma retreat that I have attended. Okay. It is a marvelous retreat indeed. We also pay our respect and reverence to Venerable Ajahn Brahm for his foresight to build a meditation retreat center like this, and for creating a conducive environment to nurture and develop teachers of your caliber. You are an excellent teacher. Okay, it's very kind of you to say all this. Please consider to conduct a similar retreat, say in October or any time convenient to you, so that you could guide us to on the path to liberation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. P.S. Thank you for your personal guidance during the two interviews as well. Okay, well, that's very encouraging, isn't it, when you get feedback like that? So we will see what happens. In the future is always uncertain, so we'll see how things go. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how does karma work when the person doesn't realize, they have the intentions to hurt another person? If you kill an insect, your karma is a short lived life or a cripple next life. But these days, they have internet dating websites. People are busy and don't have much of a social life. They go on the internet looking for like-minded friends, while with a spouse. A second relationship forms while with the first, but they say they are just looking for like-minded friends. Result is person then leaves the first spouse for the internet friend. How does karma work when the person doesn't have the intention to hurt the spouse, but ends up hurting them, leaving the relationship shattered in pieces? Is there karma here? How does it work? We are told karma is only through intention. Okay, so the intention here is, the intention is to have a second relationship, right? What is that based on? It's based on some kind of desire, whatever that desire might be, whether it's friendship or whatever it is. There's some kind of desire there that you want to, and that is the problem. You're doing an act based on desire that hurts somebody else. And that is the problem. Your intention is not to hurt them. To intend to hurt them, it has to come from anger, right, or ill will or something. But here, the consequences, however, are that this person gets hurt. So you could argue that stealing, your intent is not to hurt the person, it's just to get more for yourself, right? But still, it obviously hurts other people when you do that. So it is coming from a defiled state of mind, that is a state of mind which has desire in it, and it also leads to the hurt of the person you're with. We know that deep down, that if we go on the internet and we find someone else, we know deep down that we're going to hurt the person that we're already with. I think that's fairly obvious. How do you feel if you are in a relationship and you are very attached to this person and then they go and find somebody else? How does it feel? It feels terrible, right? It's very painful. And we should know that. If you don't know that, it means you're deluded. And that delusion itself is a state of making bad karma. If you act on delusion, that's also bad karma. So regardless, you can't really get out of this by thinking like that. There is a defilements at the, which drive this, and though, because you act on those defilements, you are hurting other people. So you should be able to know that. So remember that the best, the most, if you really want to be faithful to your partner in life, the best thing is not to really have any kind of ideas, even thoughts of romantic relationships with other people. But even your thoughts are kind of steered 100% to the person you are with, the partner you already have. There's a beautiful sutta in the, I think, the Sanghita Nikaya about two a married couple called Nakula Pita and Nakula Mata, and they were both stream enterers, right? It's pretty a married couple who are both stream enterers, and they say in the sutta, they say, they go to the Buddha, and Nakula Mata, the wife, says to the Buddha that I have never even had a thought of being unfaithful to my husband, much less acted in that way. And the husband says, I've never even had a thought of being unfaithful to my wife, much less acted that way, right? This is kind of the ideal kind of faithfulness to your partner. You don't even think, you don't even go into thinking in that area. That's how committed you are to the relationship. Much less do you go on the internet, and once the kind of these things start, they kind of take on a life of their own. It's best to kind of nip it in the bud straight away, so it doesn't get a chance to kind of develop any further. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for being a walking and talking encyclopedia of Dhamma knowledge. I benefited greatly from this retreat. Could you please tell me if the seven factors of awakening are in the suttas or later commentaries? They are definitely in the suttas. This is one of the very important kind of teachings. The Buddha often summarized his path in what is known as the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the 37 aids to awakening. And this is like the Noble Eightfold Path, the four Satipatthanas, the four right efforts, the four roads to power, Idipadas, the five faculties, the five powers, and the seven factors of awakening. That should add up to 37, unless I forgot something. I think I got them all. So these are definitely in the suttas. And there's a whole, if you're interested in reading about the seven factors of awakening, if you go to the Sanghita Nikaya, the connected discourses of the Buddha, there's a whole book there, a whole section with suttas just about the factors of awakening, called the Bhojangas in Pali. Okay, so Dear Ajahn Ramali, can you please tell us the meaning of the different colored robes that the monks wear? For instance, you are wearing light brown robes. The monks on your left. The monks on my left? No, the nuns on my left? The monks on my left? Well, left from your point of view, perhaps. Okay. The monks on your left is wearing a darker brown robe. Yeah, I guess that's true. Huh? Okay. And the monks at the funeral I attended in Thailand wore orange robes. So why is this? And the answer is the answer is that according to the Buddha allowed the monks to wear and the nuns to wear robes in a fairly wide range of colors. They have to be kind of brownish. They shouldn't be basically, the robe should be simple, right? They should be not fancy. There shouldn't be bright colors or anything like that. And they should be simple. They shouldn't have kind of fancy, kind of, they shouldn't be fancy in any way whatsoever. So basically, anything which is within a certain range of colors is acceptable. Orange is perhaps acceptable. It's hard to really, it's probably within the range. But there are certain colors which are directly forbidden by the Buddha, like black robes or blue, I think, I can't remember off the top of my head all the colors that are disallowed, but anything which is kind of within the range of brown, within whatever is considered brownish in one way or another, is usually allowed. So sometimes they will be brown on the side of green, sometimes the brown on the side of more reddish, more, and sometimes dark brown and light brown and all these kind of things. And typically the brown color, the reason they have this brown color is because they are, the color is taken from the sap of certain trees. And so you boil down certain trees. In Thailand they use what is called the jackfruit tree. And they boil these chips of the jackfruit tree till the sap comes out. And then they use that as dye in their robes. And that is how you get the kind of the typical color of the robes in Thailand. That is the traditional way of doing it. These days, everybody uses chemical dye, right? Very few people uses this old-fashioned method anymore. So this robe here is probably from a shop somewhere. I'm not sure where it's from. Probably comes from a shop somewhere, somebody bought it and offered it to the monastery, and then I wear what was offered in the monastery. So this is chemically dyed. And the traditionally there has been a distinction between the forest monks and the forest monks, because they lived in the forest, they would use the natural dyes of the trees in the forest. And on the other hand, there were the city monks, and the city monks would tend to use kind of more artificial colors, like orange, for example. So the city monks were orange and the forest monks were more brown. But then what happens is that the forest monks got very popular, right, with people, because people said, oh, the forest monks, they are the real ones. That is where we want to kind of support them. We want to do what is good for, we want to kind of support the forest monks. And so then the city monks caught on and thought, oh, we should wear the forest monk robes. And for that reason, the city monks started to wear brown robes, right, because that became the popular color. So then things became more mixed up. And this is how things often are. Things tend to work in this way. And the reason that we hear where the nuns wear the dark brown and the monks wear the light brown is so that you can tell the difference, right? Sometimes it can be hard to tell the difference. So it makes it very clear that, okay, this is a nun, this is a monk. You can see it straight away when you see the robes. It can be quite handy sometimes. Okay, so I hope that answers that one. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you so much for a marvelous 9-day retreat. The suttas were carefully selected and appropriate for lay people like us. This was especially so coupled with your detailed explanation. It was clearly understood. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Through the course of meditation and reflection, I see truckloads of my own defilements. I reckon it has to take life after life to remove them. There's a sad face. There's no need to be sad about that. What you're seeing, you're just learning about yourself, right? You're coming to terms with what the mind is really like. And that is a wonderful thing. It's not sad. It is a good news. Sometimes when we see reality, it's a bit of a shock. But actually, all you're seeing is what was already there. So there's nothing to be sad about. In fact, what it means is that you're starting to understand yourself. And when you do that, you can actually do something about it, right? This is a good thing here. However, I'm not in despair and disappointed. I will make, then there's a happy face, I will make considerable efforts to come on retreat, receive good education from you, cultivate my bodily action, speech and mind. I will make baby steps to transform myself in this life. I'm truly grateful for this opportunity to have had learned Dhamma from you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May I wish you well and happy walking towards the path of enlightenment soonest with Megametta. Okay, that's very good. Great. So this is the right attitude. When you see your defilements, you think, oh, I've got to do something about this. And you find the inspiration to practice when you see that there is a problem that needs to be resolved. So that is certainly the right way of looking at it. Dear Ajahn, has the BSWA got any future plans to help old, lonely Buddhists in nursing homes that has no internet facilities to listen to Dhamma talks? Thanks. Most nursing homes are Catholic or Christian at present. Can we have a Buddhist nursing home? I guess we can. It's just a matter of somebody doing it, I suppose. And I know that sometimes these things have been talked about. So is it really true that they have no internet facilities to listen to Dhamma talk? That's a bit strange. I thought everybody had internet these days. Maybe you have to take it up with the management in this nursing home and say, we want internet. These days, everybody's internet savvy. It doesn't matter how old you are these days. Everybody knows how to use these things. So I think that would be a good thing to do. I know that this thing has been discussed in the Buddhist society in the past. There have been interest in these things before. So I guess it is, I'm not sure if this is within the kind of constitution of the Buddhist society. The Buddhist society has a constitution. And that constitution has certain things that have been on the agenda from the beginning for the Buddhist society to do. And that was establishing a monk's monastery, establishing a nun's monastery, establishing a retreat center. All of these things were part of the Buddhist society constitution from the beginning. I'm not sure if establishing a Buddhist nursing home is part of that. I can't say with 100% certainty right now. But this is something that you need to take up with the Buddhist society committee. And I am not on that committee. So I'm quite happy to say I'm not on that committee, actually. It's difficult to be on committees, right? And I'm very appreciative of those people who do it, because it's hard work and it's difficult and it can be problematic at times. But it's a very wonderful service to do. So that is where you need to bring it up at the committee meeting. Send them a letter or whatever and say that this would be a good idea. I'm not sure if anything will come of it, but you can always give it a try. Okay. Is there any allowance for fun, laughter and playfulness in the Eightfold Path, even sometimes being silly? Sometimes there is the urge, and I don't know what to make of it. Yes, there is a lot of allowance for that. I think the more enlightened you become, the more playful you become, and the more laughter and the more you mess around and do crazy, absolutely stupid things, and people think you're a complete fool sometimes, and then you are even more silly afterwards. I think that is, yes, I think there is, but it is laughter and playfulness which is kind of without too much defilements, right? There's different types of different ways of being playful and having a good time. So it's this how you do it which really is the important thing. But I think it's wonderful to be silly. I think it's wonderful to not take oneself too seriously, right? One of the things that Ram says is that you should do if you get bored or whatever, you should do a bit of kangaroo meditation. And you should get outside and you should jump back and forth like a kangaroo and hold your hands like this. And then you start feeling very silly very quickly, right? So these are the things which you're just being playful and stupid sometimes, just to have a bit of fun and having a bit of silliness and etc. And I mean, if you have heard any talks by Ajahn Brahm, you know how silly Ajahn Brahm can be sometimes. And that is kind of is wonderful in a sense, that he can be so silly. He doesn't take himself seriously at all. He is incredibly, Ajahn Brahm is incredibly famous. You have no idea how famous he is sometimes. His books are bestsellers in places like Indonesia. Really bestsellers, right? I mean, like Ajahn Brahm is there, and then you have kind of Harry Potter underneath, and then Dan Brown, right? I mean, this kind of level. When he goes to Sri Lanka, he always goes to meet the president of Sri Lanka, and then he speaks to TV audiences of 5 million people or whatever. When he goes to Korea, he is one of the most famous monks in Korea, even though he's only been there a couple of times. And he speaks live on primetime television, these sort of things. Wherever he goes, he's like this megastar. And then he comes back to Perth and he sits down on his seat and he tells the silly jokes, right? I mean, isn't that wonderful? Usually, if you become so famous, you take yourself very seriously. But he doesn't take himself seriously at all. Sometimes people say he doesn't take himself seriously enough. But it's a wonderful thing that you don't have that sense of ego and sense of self. You're able to, and this is to me, is one of the qualities of somebody who has very deep spiritual qualities, is that they're able to deal with that kind of fame, I don't know how he does it, but he seems to be able to deal with that kind of fame. Just travel around and give talks and kind of just shrug his shoulders, right? And then doesn't really affect him very much at all. He comes back to the monastery and he sits down and he just looks like any other monk in the monastery. It's a wonderful thing. So Indeed, it's important to have fun in life. There was actually another thing about this. I remember a while ago there was an article somewhere, and there was a nurse, an Australian nurse, who wrote a book about the regrets that people have when they die. Did you see that article? Yeah, and this was the article about she had been a palliative care nurse for a long time, and she had discovered over all these years people were dying that people had certain regrets when they were dying, right? And one of the regrets was that they hadn't taken life too seriously. They hadn't just played around and messed around and been silly and stupid enough. You know, why take life so seriously? I mean, you know, is it really serious? Is this what we make of it, life, really? It's neither serious nor not. So why not just have a good time and mess around and just be stupid sometimes and relax a little bit, be light-hearted about things, you know? It doesn't have to be so serious. So it's what we make of life. That is what it becomes. So make it fun, and it becomes fun. So I support that. So you don't want to end your life in kind of, oh, I was too serious. That is not a good way of ending your life. Okay. What are your thoughts on using will and striving to succeed in the world, while still maintaining in the background a practice? A mind of renunciation. Okay, so using the will and striving to succeed in the world. There's nothing wrong with succeeding, right? But the best way to succeed is not to strive too hard or to kind of will it too much. If you strive too hard and you will it too much, the only way you can really do that is by desiring it, right? By desiring success in the world. And if you desire too much success, you're often setting yourself up for a fall. If you desire it, you will get disappointed if it doesn't work out. So often the best thing, if you have in the back of your mind a practice of renunciation, if that really is strong, you won't really be too concerned about whether you succeed in the world or not. And I have seen in my life the people who are the most successful are often the people who don't really necessarily want to succeed. They are the people who just have natural abilities and they do it because they enjoy it, right? So they go out into the world and they enjoy the job they have, they enjoy what they're doing, they have a positive attitude towards everything they do. And because of that positive attitude and the positive outlook, that is why they succeed, and not because they have this incredible drive or this incredible striving. They strive because they enjoy it, and not because of the drive of the desire. They strive because they feel that they are adding something to the world, right? Their job is producing something good for the world. It's a bit like being a monk. You know, you're hoping and you're feeling that you're adding something of value by being a monk, both for yourself and for everybody else. And the people I have seen who have striven, who have had most success, and I've seen some pretty successful people out there, have been people who had this very positive attitude, and they do it for a positive reason. And that's when you succeed. And this is this beautiful saying which Ajahn Brahm has said sometimes. He says that success doesn't produce happiness. Happiness produces success. You're already happy. You already have a good life. You do things because you enjoy it. And you don't strive very hard because you think that by succeeding you will become happy. So get things the right way around, and then you will succeed. Sometimes if you are striving too hard, and you are kind of, you have sharp elbows and you're trying to push everybody else out of the way and you're competing with everyone else, people get afraid of you, right? They think, whoa, this person, they're very ambitious. And when people get afraid of you, it's more difficult for them to allow you to move forward and to kind of go higher. People will hold you back because they are jealous or they are afraid, right? And then you get politics and problems. But if you are the kind of person who doesn't really care whether you advance or not, or whether you get a higher salary or not, and you're happy with whatever you're doing, and you're doing things because you enjoy it, people are not afraid of you. They don't feel vulnerable in your presence. And because of that, it's more likely that you will get the advancement sometimes. It's funny how these things work. Sometimes by having a good time, by not being trying so hard, sometimes you have more success in that way. And this is also something I have observed sometimes in life. Don't use too much will. Just enjoy what you're doing already. And then perhaps that is sometimes the best way to success. It also needs to be said that there is nothing wrong with success as such. Success is fine. But remember what is important in life, what really matters. Remember that whatever success, this is one of the things I said when I was talking about sensual objects and sensual pleasures in the world. Remember that all the success you have in this life, it stays in this life. You can't take it with you into the future. It is limited to the here and now. So even if you have tremendous success, you have to leave it behind. What people say when they die is what they remember. It's not the success they had, whether they advanced on the career path or whether they had a great salary. That's not what you remember when you die. What you remember when you die is whether what kind of relationships you had, whether you were kind-hearted, whether you were good, whether you did the right things. Those are the things you remember when you die. So do the stuff that you will remember when you pass away. So you take all that with you into the future. That is what matters. If you then have success on the way, great. But then it doesn't matter so much anymore. So use the big picture. Remember what truly is important in life. And then things usually come together one way or another. It's important to have one's priorities right. And when you have that, then usually things go well. Okay. Last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, thank you for teaching the Sutta class on this retreat. I have learned so much on this retreat. I feel like doing a happy dance. Okay. Thank you, Ajahn, for imparting your wisdom and knowledge to us. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Ajahn, I too hope to get into jhana and get enlightened, just like you. Okay. I'm trying to be a good person, but I'm not quite there yet. So, Ajahn, before I go home, can you please tell me the lotto numbers? Okay. So, anyone who tells you the lotto numbers, you know straight away that you don't can't trust that person. That's number one, right? So don't follow that kind of thing. So that is the bad way, the way going down when we focus on those kind of things. Anyway, so that is the Q&A for this evening. So tomorrow I will see you again at 6 a.m. if you want to come out. And then after that there will be a meeting after breakfast, quarter to eight, Bianca? Yeah, okay, quarter to eight. And then there will be another very last sutta reading. The culmination of the gradual training will be a 9:15 in here. And I think we will just keep on doing that for, I'm not sure how long it's going to take, maybe an hour or so. And then all the nuns, they have to leave at 9:30. Yeah, so we probably just keep going until 9:30. And I think when they have to leave, it's probably a good time for us all to maybe stop at that particular point.
Otherwise
it's too short. Yeah, so 8:15 to 9:30. Sorry, yeah, thank you, Ananda. That's good, yeah. So 8:15 to 9:30 tomorrow. So please enjoy your last night here, right? Because it's amazing how quickly things pass away and how they go. These 9 days, just like that, and they vanished when you come to an end. So make use of this last time. You don't know when or if or whatever you will have a chance again. Probably you will, but you never know. So just enjoy the very last time, last few moments, last few hours at the retreat center. And just remember that you will be missing this probably when you go back home again afterwards. Okay, so see you again tomorrow morning here.